Shalom, everybody, and welcome to the Yishai Fleisher Show, broadcasting on the Land of Israel Network, and also on my YouTube page, Ion Zion, and also right now on Periscope for the first time. So I'm very excited to be with all of you right now, and we have a great show lined up for you with Rabbi Mike Foyer. We're going to be talking about the Torah portion, Naso. We're going to be getting ready for Shavuot, some political stuff as well. And so without further ado, let's welcome Rabbi Mike Foyer into the stream. Rabbi Mike, shalom and welcome.
Hi, it's good to be in the stream with you, Shai.
Yes, it's good to be. We're
like
swimming
islands
together.
In the stream. We're like islands in the stream, my friend.
Is that what it is? Islands in the
That's
stream?
What
like
we are.
Huckleberry Finn type of thing?
So, you know, you can get the song reference later.
Oh, I didn't know that one. I thought I remember Huck Finn was on an island in the stream.
Sure. We can do that.
That's right. That's right. That was always a good image for me. First thing, I want to wish you a congratulations. Because we are towards the end of the Omer count. Today's 48. Really, one more day to count.
And one more.
It's a big deal to get through this count. And I want to tell you something that you said to me a few weeks ago on this very channel, on this very show. You told me something that has that really affected me. You mentioned that this part of the year, I'm not going to get into the two different counts, but there's the high holidays part of the year, and then there's this part of the year that leads into Shavuot, from Pesach to Shavuot. This one, you said, is the more national interest one, as opposed to the other one, which is personal rectification. This one's national interest one, and that has guided me throughout this period, and I'm very excited for the kind of big show of national unification, if you will, at the foot of the Temple Mount, which is really supposed to be the place where we receive the Torah. And so I'm very kind of excited for this national gathering, even though not the whole nation is going to gather there, but that feeling that's really what this holiday of Shavuot is all about.
And this year we'll stay 6 feet apart. Of course,
there'll be we'll stay a little bit apart. We'll be ke'ish echad belev echad,
but socially distanced.
That's right. And that's a funny time. But this is something that I also talked about with Malka on her half of the show. The corona illness really did come at this very time. There was something about a national consciousness and national rectification which happened through this period. I want to tell you that I saw a shocking graphic yesterday of where the disease hit in the United States. And it was basically New York, New Jersey, Long Island, and a few other places. But it struck the hardest exactly where the Jewish populations were. And to me, the way I read that is the reason I'm kind of stuttering is because I want to be careful with the words. I don't want anybody to get their feelings hurt. And I don't want to say anything that is hurtful because that's not what I mean. But there is a limitation, a lessening of the power of the Jewish diaspora, I think, as we're coming back to the land of Israel. And to me, this was, however you want to understand it, it somehow lessened the influence and the power of the diaspora and made them feel more homesick for the land of Israel.
Yeah, it's a lot of heavy themes in that. But something that comes up for me is the fact that in America, communal life is institutional life for most Jews. Orthodox, non-Orthodox, the synagogue, the community centers, you know, that's where a community exists. And in this time of social distancing, I know from speaking to family and students and friends that it's been a real challenge to feel like you're part of a community. I mean, the Zoomiverse only goes so far. But one of the things that's been driven home to me, and we've spoken about it here before, is the fact that, you know, the highlight of this, and go all the way back to the beginning of the Omer, is the morning after our Seder. So the holiday of Chag, Pesach, we had a full davening out on the porches of our buildings. Somebody was down on their porch reading Torah. Nobody was, the guy was on his porch leading Hallel. And we were all together because, for us, the fabric of community is physical. Not that Jews don't live together in the places in a diaspora, but what it means to be in the land of Israel is that from the ground up, we're building Am Yisrael. And something as simple as the fact that we all have porches that are built for Sukkot, so they like slightly face each other, etc. So like we can actually be together in our separateness. Like, to me, it was a very strong symbolic representation of the other side of what you're saying, which is America, community can be very strong, but it's always going to be superimposed on the topography of a non-Jewish world and therefore weaker, for better or worse. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to build ground up here, and I hope we take to heart some of the lessons of this very challenging time.
Yeah, I think there's going to be changes in the way people relate to their personal life and to relate to the state of Israel, the land of Israel, and relate to just the opportunities that life gives them. At the same time, while I think people are going to be very excited to start a life again, at the same time, coming out of hibernation has not been that easy.
Yeah, much harder to go out than in.
Right.
Well, think about it. I mean, it's a crisis. The going in was the crisis mode. And I think that's, in my estimation, I've been speaking about this a lot with a couple of friends of mine, because the social psychology of this pandemic is going to be studied for decades. Remembering that it's far from unique. I myself made a mistake. We spoke about it here. Someone asked, like, when was the last time such a thing happened? In 1918, you know, the Spanish flu that killed tens of millions of people was the reference point. Truth is, it's false. It's not true. I've since discovered that in 1968, there was a pandemic called the Hong Kong flu before people got all uptight about what you call flu, right? Killed a million people globally. A million people. My mom, I was speaking to my mom about it because she was telling me about the sociologist who read this. That's my mom. She's reading sociology papers. What do you want? But her point was that in 1968, she got married. She had 200 people at her wedding. She doesn't remember anybody even talking about it. It was Woodstock. And her take was that the world was led by people who had survived World War II. Many of them had probably the Great Depression, perhaps even World War I, depending on, you know, where they were in the arc of their leadership. And their primary instinct was not just to keep people safe. They had driving values. They had big vision. And I think a lot of what happened on the way in to to sheltering, to the lockdown, is people felt a sense of purpose and clarity in the crisis. But whatever I have to do, I have to stock up, it's going to be hard, you know, boom, going in. Coming out raises all the questions of, like, what does life mean? And how are we going to overcome the more daily challenges? And how do I adjust to and shape a new reality? You hear what I'm saying? Inevitably, it's messier because so often we lack vision to guide us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Also, a lot of businesses are going to be deciding if they hire or rehire somebody, or like if they bring somebody back in. So too, a lot of household economics, you're like, well, I was in this weekly class and I paid for it. Do I need to do that? Maybe I don't need to do that. So those are both just examples that there's like a shakeup in the financial, but also therefore in the personal decision-making. Everybody's like, well, what do I need or what I don't need? If I had such a reset, if the reset button was hit. By the way, every piece of hardware that we have needs a reset. Every single one of them, yeah. Except for maybe the toaster. You know. And when the toaster doesn't need a reset, it needs to be thrown out because it doesn't have the power to be reset. So I guess the simpler you are, the less reset you need, but then you become obsolete easier. My point is that there's been a global reset on an individual level and on a grand, you know, on a meta level,
social scale,
and you know, the only thing that really bothers me is whenever I look at my Twitter feed, I look at America again, and it's more like we say it here in Hebrew, it's got like a less of a violent kind of connotation, but it's like it's lost its human face. Like Ibed Selem Enosh. It's losing its it's not people like anymore. It's become like a kind of madness and it's
the,
like
the granny killers versus the deep state. That's what I'm
right,
calling.
Right, and the Trump type of thing, like F you, F. It's like, guys, calm down. Like, be civil again, you know? And that breakdown of civility coming from this great source of soft power in this world, cultural soft power, I don't know. It's I don't know if the word scaring me is right, but it's definitely – it's irking me. I'm a little bit irked by this, like – I can't look at people in this kind of discourse. What do you think? Is there any what's the healing for this bomb? Nobody, and they don't even seem to feel like they're in a emotional crisis. It's like this is the new normal.
Yeah, I mean, so many things come up for me there, both from my counseling side and from the historical side. But since we're in the lead up to Shavuot, I'll just point out the sort of like famous notion that that we receive the Torah k'ish echad k'lev echad. Right, we received Torah as one, like we were one person with one heart, and that's a language which is associated in many places in our liturgy and elsewhere. That to get the light of God, you got to be together. And I think that America right now is facing a crisis point, which is part of the arc of its history as an empire. I mean, no empire stays on top forever, and the question I see hovering either over America or bubbling up from underneath, really, more accurately, is, well, what really unites us, right? Meaning, as long as we were the most prosperous, powerful nation in the world, so then that there's a, you know, the momentum alone keeps us together. Right now, that America is struggling, and I feel for the country as a whole and the people as individuals and all the struggles, right? The question bubbling up is, does anything substantive really unite us? And I think that we here in Israel have faced a similar question, but it's a much easier answer, which is, yes, there's much which unites us. There's also much which divides us, and we're Jews, and you put us in the room, we're going to argue, et cetera, et cetera. We've got, you know, a couple of million Arab citizens and residents in our land, and that's a pretty divisive itch. But bottom line, we know who we are and why we're here, right? And that's an educational challenge to keep pushing and deepening that sort of growth of that. In America, I feel like no one's even trying anymore.
It's a little Tower of Babel. It feels like the Tower of Babel, where you're building something, but it doesn't have its own purpose anymore.
Yeah.
And its only purpose is to kind of fight purpose, if you will, because you need to create an alternative purpose. You don't want to go under the subservience to God rubric. And so you become God's enemy. I remember, by the way, when September 11th happened, my first thought was Tower of Babel. I remember that. I was thinking to myself, one, it's a tower that reaches the heavens, and it's one language, which is the financial language, which unites the world. It's called the World Trade Center.
Right.
And it went down, and it got taken down. And I remember thinking that, like right now, I'm feeling that again, which is like, there's nothing human anymore. There's nothing sweet anymore. There's no love, I would say. There's no love. There's no love that unifies.
Without commitment, there's no such thing as love. I would say that what's really starting to fray in the American discourse is a sense of commitment to the society, independent of my views of whether this leader or that movement. No, listen, we're committed to American society, whether it embodies itself in the Constitution or whether it embodies itself in the government, whatever your image of it. Is that and this is something that we need to take to heart in our society, because there are elements in our society, right? And you and I sort of mingle with them sometimes.
That's what I meant before. That I get scared because the American, you know, there's like an old adage here in Israel that whatever happens in America comes here in 5 or 10 years, and when that is the broadcast coming, the projection coming out of America, it has an inevitable impact on the whole world, and certainly in Israel as well.
And, you know, it's a very important point you're raising, that we need to begin educationally and culturally to offer a serious alternative. And that alternative is a deep commitment to our society, whether it in the moment or in the aspect we're looking at embodies our vision and ideals or not. And that's the thing that has to be appreciated, is that there are a lot of challenges within our society. I'm sure you and I could go from now to the end of the show and just list off the challenges and the blah, blah, blah. Right, and they're real and they're important. But as is true with all successful relationships, and there's no such thing as a successful relationship that doesn't have real challenges. The difference between one succeeds and the one that fails, to some degree, I would say the critical difference is the degree of commitment to the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're committed, then the relationship becomes a vessel for each of you becoming the person that you could be. If you're not committed, you start knocking holes and swinging sticks, and you sink the ship.
Even disagreements and divorces need to be done in a civil way. And our Torah actually describes to us conflicts between man and wife and civil society as well, and how to deal with it properly, including divorce. So yesterday I went to the rabbinical court in order to stand as a witness. I actually, along with Malka, went to see a couple who's a friend of ours, who we've been at their house quite a few times, went yesterday to be witnesses at their divorce. It's not proceedings, it's rabbinical proceedings, to sign the get plus the divorce agreement plus the transfer of money all took place right in front of our eyes yesterday. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand, it was quite a sad day.
Sure.
Like Malka and I came back home a little freaked out, but I was mentally prepared to be freaked out. I was mentally prepared not to be mentally prepared. So that was what we saw, but I also,
for sure.
I also actually wanted to go see an unpleasant mitzvah done. And what I mean by that is there is a commandment to get divorced. Not that one should get divorced, but if one is to get divorced, the Torah lays out the proper, the proper methodology so that a really human, sad human thing can take place in its proper and civil and holy and godly manner.
Gives us the vessels. It gives us the vessels to hold a very difficult experience in a way which is meant to be growthful and, God willing, ultimately healing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's right. And so my friend who was getting divorced, my male friend, because the both of them are my friends, said to me, how could somebody work here? Because, see, there's all kinds of people working there. And right. I said, this place isn't so bad. The people that get divorced here get divorced and hopefully start their life again and start maybe something bigger and better for themselves. The hospitals are tougher in some ways than this place. I mean, you see healing and you see babies being born, but you also see
end of life.
Right. Yeah. By the way, imagine if somebody said to one of our cells, you know, if a heart cell said to a colon cell, oh, I can't believe you work in that. It's such a dirty job. Like, you know what I mean? We'd be in total trouble.
Right? You got a crappy job, man.
Yeah, you got a crappy job. It's but the other guy says I have to be on duty. So the point is,
we're not making me laugh. I told you before the show, no laughing. No laughing. It hurts.
Okay. So my point is to you that yeah, you know, there's cells in charge of the colon. And that digestion is and the flushing out of waste is an absolutely essential human thing. You've got to do the stuff that's dirty well.
Yes.
You've got to do it properly. And so also our Torah portion actually deals with a very tricky topic, which on the face of it may not seem politically correct, which is
like
the
much
question.
Of Torah.
Right. Which is about something called the sota, which is when a man warns his wife that he is jealous of her behavior vis-a-vis another man. And he says, do not unite yourself with him. And at some point, if potentially there may be some concern that she may have done this, then he can bring her to the temple and force her to drink this drink that may lead, if indeed an adulterous relation has happened, her and her lover mate into punishment by death from heaven. Of course, she can avert that in many ways by either admitting it right from the get-go or saying, I don't want to drink this thing. And she can be cut loose of this potentially dangerous drinking. On the other hand, if she is indeed innocent of these claims, and he himself is the one who has an issue vis-a-vis that he's overly jealous, unnecessarily jealous, unjustly jealous, well, she's going to be blessed with child. We have a whole Talmud tract dedicated to this, and it's actually one of the most interesting Talmud tracts with a lot of great stories called Masechet Sota, one of my favorites. So just wanted to throw that out there to you, like, why is the Torah telling us about a man's jealousy and a woman's potential infidelity, potentially taking her to the temple where a scroll which has the name of God is put into water and diluted to the point that God's name is erased, something that's generally not allowed to be done.
It's a very serious issur. It's a very serious prohibition.
So what does the Torah lay out for me of this whole sota business?
I mean, we could take so many layers on this, and I before we go deep, I think it is important just to register the simple sort of psychosocial layer here, which is that that jealousy and possessiveness within relationship is a corrosive and destructive element, right? That this is the Torah putting up a backboard of hopefulness to a society and otherwise which in a woman becomes an object of a man's jealousy and likely will be condemned to death at his own hands. Let's just remember that we're dealing with a person who has some rational basis, but no evidence. So meaning on some level, what we're looking at here is a social institution, as is true many in the Torah, which deals with the reality of the culture in which it was given and is an attempt to force it to evolve through legislation, through ritual, through guidance toward a more socially conscious stance. As we've said before many times, the Torah doesn't appear politically correct because in many ways it created the moral sensitivity which underlies the positive side of political correctness. There are other things in political correctness that I have no need to attribute to the Torah. But on a deeper level, it's also pointing out to us that the relationship between a man and a woman, a loving relationship between two individuals, is the foundation of all life in Torah. Right? And that the place when that relationship is out of balance, the place where you drag it to, so to speak, is sanctity. Right? And unless you think that dragging it to the temple is going to be a bowing before God, it's this incredible inversion of power. It's like, I'm going to drag you into the temple and you know, put all my dirty laundry up into the sacred precinct and have the priests and God go new. No, it's God going to say, listen, this is so important to me. Wipe me out. I want you to understand. You guys got to work this out. It's more important to me that you work this out than that my name be preserved in the world, because mm-hmm. in the end of the day, my name will be preserved in a much higher level through your right relationship.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting what you're saying about the name erasure, because you could have taken it the other way, which is, okay, like, I'm jealous, but I guess I'm not the ultimate arbiter, am I? Like, I'm going to bring you to the temple, but the minute I do that, I'm not beating you up, God forbid. I'm not, like, in charge of everything. I'm not doing, what do they call it in the Islamic world, the honor killing?
Honor killing.
No, I'm not doing that.
Remember that blood vengeance is very present in the Torah when it comes to accidental murder. And this is the other side of that culture where the Torah has mm-hmm. created a whole institution to try to head that off.
Right. Come to the temple and let God figure it. Like, on the one hand, it's let God figure it out. But you're saying that God says back to them, your relationship is more important to me than my name. But I want to add an interesting thing to that. You know, the standard Dvar Torah is that Shalom Bayit is above God's name. God's name is willing to be erased for Shalom Bayit, for peace in the home. But I want to add one more layer to that, which is the halacha is that if a man wants to leave to the land of Israel and the wife is against it, he can divorce her and not give her her ketubah, her like
the money
she's owed, right? Or same if the woman wants to go to the land of Israel and the husband is unwilling, she has the right to divorce him and get her ketubah and move to the land of Israel. So what the halacha there is that, let's go back, peace in the home is more important than God's name, but moving to the land of Israel is more important than peace in the home. I'm willing if you want to start your life in the land of Israel, I'm willing to go a long way. I mean, that is pretty that's pretty audacious halacha there.
It is, and the only reason I was not shaking my head like that is because I think that we shouldn't mistake God's name, the role of God's name in this, is that God's name written on a piece of paper is a powerful indicator of something which is much bigger than what's written there.
Mm-hmm.
It's a symbol. And so therefore, it's a symbol that we are enjoined and trained to treat with deep respect. The book falls, you kiss it, you write God's name on something, you don't throw it away, you bury it respectfully in a keniza, et cetera, right? It has sanctity once the scroll in your tefillin or the mezuzah, et cetera, like that name goes on there and boom, it's jumped up a whole level. It's chefzah shel kedusha, as we call it. But what God's saying is that there's a name which exists within your relationship, which is higher than that. That when a man and a woman form a relationship of trust, of empathy, they become a vessel for God's name in the world, for the shechina, as we say, that's for God's presence. And then odioter, that the national life of Am Yisrael restored in the vessel of the land is the highest sanctification of God's name there could be, right? That's what it says in Yechezkel, that when God says, I'm gonna bring you back, basically, because my name has been disgraced amongst the nations while you're in exile. Right. It's not about you, says God. It's about me. It's like, because my name is great when I'm Israel is in the land.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of circles us back to where we started the discussion, is that if we want to have a society in which we can hold together, we don't have the illusion that we can get rid of differences, because that's a ridiculous illusion. But rather, those differences can, like between a man and a woman, become productive. Then what there has to be a mutual commitment that our very differences and the engagement in the struggle should be a sanctification of God's name. On the personal, on the interpersonal, and on the national level. And the vessel for the national level is in the land. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
All right, folks, you are watching the Yishai Fleischer Show, Rabbi Mike Foyer from the Pardes Institute, and your other show, Jewish Story, found at jewishstory.co, joins me. I know that there's a few people for the first time that I'm broadcasting today on Periscope. So if you want to comment, please do. I think I'll be able to see your comments. So please do comment from Periscope. Just give me a shout out saying you hear us, you're connected. And of course on YouTube as well. So really appreciate that. So we spoke about the couple that got divorced this week. There's my first comment from Context Symphony, saying thank you from Periscope, and thank you very much for saying thank you. I really appreciate it. And
thank you, Doctor.
And so it's just good to connect. I appreciate that. Tell me if Mr. Context, if you could tell me if it's working for you well, the Periscope model. I appreciate that. So speaking of, we talked a little bit about the divorce. I want to say kind of like God forbid, but then again, like, yes, God forbid people should get divorced. And yet on the other hand, there was a mitzvah involved in it. We talked about that.
Yeah.
So too.
By the way, what I try to say to people when I hear they've gotten divorced is it should be for a blessing.
Right.
Right. Meaning it's for some people, it's a terrible thing. For some people, it's the best thing that ever happened to them.
Right.
And so therefore it has the potential to be a blessing.
Right. And let's also, of course, before the show, you mentioned this to me, which is correct, which is let's bless the kids, the children of these divorces who oftentimes really do bear the brunt of it. So Bezrat Hashem, they should do well. And I think that both of those parents would agree to that phrase. Now let's take it to the next level, which is the Torah tells us, and we're in Parshat Naso in the fourth Aliyah. It tells us that, okay, if you it actually comes to the next story, the next issue. And that next issue is the Nazir, translated poorly into English, the Nazirite, not the Nazarene. Different religion.
Different
thing, yeah. I'm talking about the Nazirite, and that is a man, but I think it can be a woman as well. Who decides to take upon themselves, his and herself, this life limitation, life limitation. What did you call it?
It's a vow.
It's a vow. That person will no longer, the being a Nazarene, being a Nazaristic to that, means that you no longer are allowed to take any pleasure, any eating pleasure from grape products. That means you're not allowed to eat grape leaves, but you're certainly not allowed to have raisins, but you're certainly not to have wine. That's what it's really about, wine.
And no, you're not allowed to arak.
Well, that's what I wanted to understand. It's interesting because I thought the arak is not a grape product.
I believe it's distilled. Oh, it's anise. You're right.
Yeah, it's anise. No, but there are, what you meant is brandy.
Brandy.
Brandy, like 777, Sheva Sheva Sheva, right? The Israel's wonderful brandy. You're not allowed to have that. You're not allowed to cut your hair. And you're not allowed to expose yourself to the energy of a body that died. You're not allowed to come in contact with a dead body, except for one, by the way, which is the dead body of a so-called met mitzvah, a person who nobody else, you
there's
walk
no
on the road.
To take care of it.
Right. There's nobody else to bury the body. You're allowed to do that. But so is a Kohen Gadol.
Right.
So important is that the sanctity of a body, that nobody else could take care of it. But in any case, our sages tell us that the reason this person decided to become a Nazir is because he likely saw a sota, a woman that has disgraced herself with extramarital affairs. He saw her in her ruinous moment. And so he decided to kind of step away from worldly pleasures by distancing himself or herself from such actions and taking upon themselves the vow. The most famous of these Nazirim is Shimshon. Shimshon, who is a Nazir from birth, although his laws are a little bit different, but he is not only is he so famous, but even in this Shabbat's Haftorah, the reading from the prophets, from the book of Judges in our case, I think chapter 16 or maybe 15 because it's early on, but that is the story of the birth of this very special figure, Shimshon. So let's talk a little bit about this Nazir. I think the simple way to throw it out to you, Rabbi Mike, is being a Nazir a good or a bad thing?
I mean, you know, the answer to the Torah is yes and, right? Because on some level, it's a mitzvah. So therefore, we assume that there is something positive in one's relationship to the world and to one another and to God, which comes from it. Otherwise, it wouldn't be an option, right? And they, at the same time, you know, the framing that you gave, that the sages say that the reason that the two parshiot are juxtaposed, that the description of the sota and the description of the nazir are back-to-back in our parsha, is because of this sort of like strange narrative thread. It's like, he was in the temple and he saw the woman in her moment of disgrace and he said, oh, she's pretty. Oh my goodness. You know, I better do something about that. It comes to tell us that this is an extreme measure. An extreme measure which is sanctioned out of recognition that sometimes in order to keep ourselves focused on that which is right and true in our lives, we have to clamp down on behaviors which are not themselves intrinsically wrong. Remembering, of course, that certainly wine is not only not seen as problematic within the culture of the Torah and certainly in the Jewish culture. It's a source of sanctity. Every you know, what I always picture, you know, on Friday with a Nazir is that, you know, in theory, you can make Kiddush, you can sanctify Shabbat on bread if you don't have wine, but it's a serious downgrade in what you're doing. So I picture like the Nazir, it's like every week that he thinks he's getting a little holy with his vows and his self-control. It's like every week there's just a little bit of reminder of like, no, you're missing it. It's true you're taking control of your life and you're disciplining yourself and that focus. And by the way, it's also remember that the Stam Nazir, Shimshon's not a great example of a Nazir because he didn't make a decision to be a Nazir. He was a Nazir declared by God from birth. The Stam Nazir, the standard time period we're talking about is only 30 days.
30 days. It's an extreme diet.
It's an extreme diet for 30 days in recognition that there's some way I need to do a inner clarification of values. And that's so much of what this is about.
All right. So when I was in college, I took with the famous classics professor, Dr. Louis Feldman. And I say famous because in that world, he is famous. He was one of the world's, foremost Josephus scholar and taught classics. And when I say classics, I mean Greek and Roman mythology.
He's the guy they tell that joke about that whenever missionaries would come to his door, he'd said he'd be happy to discuss the New Testament with them, but only if they did it in the original Greek.
I heard that joke about him several times.
I was looking at him if you knew him, if it was true or not.
Yeah, I never heard that one. He never said that one, but he was a very special man, a very, very special man. And I had the great privilege of taking mythology. And this is an observant Jew. Observant Jew who lives in his mind in the time of Josephus, and he's right there, and what a humor he had with regarding to the, you know, Greek mythology. And we went through the Iliad, we went through the Odyssey. It was great. It was by the way something that almost only happens at Yeshiva University, but in any case, you know, you have this, you know, Orthodox Jew expert in Greek mythology, and you're just going through with him.
Probably
going
to find that, yeah.
So I remember very well studying the story of Narcissus, and Narcissus is basically this young lad, and he looks down into this pool of water and he falls in love with himself or this other image, and he's erotically drawn to this other image, and every time he says I love you, there's this other god that's called Echo, and she echoes back I love you. And every time he would reach down into the water, he would feel he wanted to hold on to his beloved image, but the water would become murky and it would be lost, and he died there from unrequited love. And there the Narcissus, Narcisse flower grew where he died. Right. And this is an allusion towards homoeroticism. This is according to the Greeks, allusion towards homoeroticism, masturbation, the whole gamut of that world. Now, why do I mention this? You may wonder.
I think I know why you're mentioning it.
You know, but maybe a lot of folks in the town that don't. What's that?
Do we have a guest on the show right now?
We have a guest there.
Didn't realize the camera put it that way.
That's okay. No big deal. We are Zooming, so people can Zoom.
Okay.
We just had a Zoom bomb. We had a Zoom bomb. In any case, the Talmud tells us in about four places in the Talmud a great story about a young lad who came to the temple after being a Nazir to shave off his hair. And when it was Yochanan ben Zakkai, I don't remember who it was, looked at him and saw that he was a good-looking lad, said, lad, why did you become a Nazir? Why did you take this vow? And he said, well, I looked into the pool. I saw an image. I felt attracted to that image. And I yelled at this image saying, who do you think you are trying to entrap me into this way of thinking? You know, do you think do you not recognize your creator who made you out of nothing? And you are not to be, I'm not supposed to fall in love with you. I'm supposed to kind of, and immediately he rejected that, that sense and became a Nazir.
Yes.
So, I mean, it's so evidently a one-to-one fight with the Greco-Roman story of Narcissus. It's like one-to-one. It's like, I felt that feeling and I said, no, darn you. And I fought it and I chose this other path of stern, a diet of what I see and what I touch and what I do, because I don't want to go down that path of the Yetzer Hara, of the evil inclination.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I think it's not such a fight with the legend of Narcissus. It's just a much more hopeful ending. Because the way that the Greek, you know, the power of Greek mythology and much of Greek thought is that it's quite profound in its understanding of human psychology.
Sure.
And that element of Narcissus is there in all of us in this sort of idealized notion of self-love. And what the sages are telling you is like, okay, that'll get you nowhere. because life is about relationship. And relationship is about accepting the ugly, messy, imperfect aspect of yourself, which is what you see in other that you reject. Always remember that most of the time when relationships break down, a lot of the time, when relationships break down, it's because the other who we care for has become a mirror for the thing in ourself which we refuse to see. And therefore, we must destroy them in order to avoid seeing it in ourselves. It can be something as prosaic as being threatened by the wrinkles I see on my spouse's face because I don't want to get old. And it can be things much more profound. And what the sages are telling you is that you have a choice choosing life. And in this case, choosing life is cutting yourself off and getting a grip. Remember, choosing life really would be, meat, wine, and, and partying in the temple in an appropriate fashion. But in this case, in order to right that instinct and to avoid the illusion that the ideal of self-love will go anywhere other than narcissism, so you have to actually pull back. And the power of the structure here is quite profound. Mm-hmm. And I would point out, just as a last piece, the reason I understand it, that the only mitzvah that trumps the status of Nazir is mate mitzvah, is the dead body, which has no one else who can deal with it, is because ultimately this is about the sanctity of the embodied life. You might think the Nazir, by refusing to drink wine and, removing himself from the hair care world or whatever it is, you know, it's like, no, the physical world is meaningless and empty, and I'm retreating to my hilltop. If that were the case, you'd think he should kick that dead body as it goes by. Like, ugh, the filthy flesh. No, you need to understand something, that the role of Am Yisrael is to sanctify the body, never to reject it, because it's right. The vessel that God has given us to serve with.
I think it's Yehuda Cohen who says a lot of times, I think you've said it to me also, which is like, our job is not to spiritualize the physical, but to materialize the spiritual, to bring spirituality in. Right, embodiment.
For sure.
Our friend Periscope, Context Symphony, says, Freud calls the narcissistic element the ideal ego, which often persecutes us for not living up to it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's a trap, because in the same way we can't live up to our own ideal, we fall in the same trap when we look at the people we love. Mm-hmm. They'll never live up to the idealized version, because they're not ideals. They're real people.
Interesting that a person who could have loved himself a lot would have been Samson, heroic, powerful, maybe good looking. It doesn't say that, but maybe, you know.
I said, you know, it was popular with the ladies.
Right, with the ladies.
With the Canaanite women.
That's right. Philistine. Yeah. And that's right. But at the end, interestingly, he is our story of a kind of suicide. He, and I mean, his whole life is a kind of suicide, where he's constantly doing things in order to start up with the Philistines, and his people are not there yet. The Jews are not there yet. In fact, the tribe of Judah will bind him and hand him over to the Philistines. So they're obviously in a weak place. And here he comes, this kind of, first thing, he's the Greek hero, right? If there's one guy who you would say is
a mythic Greek hero, for sure. Yeah.
Right. If there's one character in the whole Torah that's a little bit like that, you're like, all right, if there's a Zeus, it's Lahavdil, it's Shimshon.
Or Hercules, at least, yeah.
A Hercules, good. And at the end, though, he ends up killing himself, and he says, Tamud Nafshim Plishtim, like, let my soul die together with the Philistines, and he brings down the house.
Literally,
right? That literally brings down the house upon them. But he, in one way, he is the opposite of self-love.
Well, because he embodies spirit nefesh.
Right.
I mean,
self-sacrifice.
Self-sacrifice, but in its simple sense, limsul nefesh just means to give over your soul.
Right.
I mean, they, and that was both his, as we say, his tikkun and his kilkul. He was completely given over to whatever it was that he did. And which is how he ended up in such messy situations, right? And it's how he, in the end, redeemed. And I think it's how he embodies the key message that God was sending to Am Yisrael in that era that they lacked, as you said. Right? The men of Yehuda bind him and hand over the enemy. Why? Because they don't believe in themselves that they can fight the Plishtim. And it says, Huechal, right? He began the battle against the Plishtim. Ultimately, who is the one who finishes the battle against the Plishtim? David. Yeah. Right, and he's the one who was kol kulo masur l'Hashem, right? He's completely given over to God,
right.
And he's able to build a nation which can hold that. But yeah, the Shimshon really begins that path.
All right, let's go to the second to last topic that I'd like to cover with you today, and that is the priestly blessing. One of the oldest findings that we found in archaeology is a copy of this priestly blessing. And the priestly blessing is
the oldest written version of the biblical text.
Right.
The silver scroll you're talking about.
The silver scroll, correct. And it's something, if you ever see it, by the way, look it up on the Wikipedia. It's beautiful, amazing picture. Yeah. And the silver scroll, and there it is. It just says these three sentences. Yivarecha Hashem v'yishmarecha, Ya'er Hashem panav alecha v'yichuneka, Yisa Hashem panav alecha v'sen lecha shalom. And then some people add the last line, which is V'sam v'shmi avnei Yisrael v'ani avachem. And the reason I know this so well by heart is because this is also something that the priests bless us here in the land of Israel every day, if indeed there is an outdoor, if there's an indoor minyan or just a minyan of Jews praying. But we also bless our children Friday night with that blessing. That's part of it. This is the, like, you want to bless the Jewish children, says God to the priests. This is the text to do it. This is how to do it. This will encompass everything. Let me just get to the page there. And we're talking about, by the way, we're in the book of Bamidbar. We started the book of so-called Numbers. I think that's the least successful of the biblical names, Numbers.
The book is not about Numbers. There's a lot of it. There is a lot of it. It's fair. At least it's like a warning. Like, folks, you should just know there's a lot of it.
I think after you called it In the Desert, yeah, it would have been just fine. So they should have taken a cue from the Jewish name there. Say to them,
the rabbinic name was Sefer Pikudim.
What's that?
The rabbinic name was Sefer Pikudim, which is much closer to Numbers.
Pikudim means the name, the book of those
everyone getting their job.
Right, but remember what I always say, which is Sefer Dvarim is the book of politics. So yeah. Pikudim is exactly that. You got this job. You got this job. You're going to fight about it. Okay. So you're supposed to say this blessing out loud. That's what Amor Lahem says, meaning to say it out loud. Yevarechecha, that your property, your the stuff that you own should be blessed. But yevishmerecha, that the stuff that you do get, may it be protected so you don't lose it, so that your Bitcoin will stay up, okay? Not only shall you get Bitcoin, but it shall
maintain its value.
That's right. Now, the most exciting one to me is this one. Listen to this. I'm going to blow your mind away now. You ready? You ready, right, Rabbi Mike?
Ready to be blown.
Ya'er Hashem panav elecha. May Hashem send his light of his face onto you. Says Rashi, six words, which I think are shocking. Here we go. Ya'er lecha panim sochakot panim tzehubot. He shall show you, when we say that God should light his face to you, he'll show you a smiley face or a happy or laughing face, a yellow face. In other words, God is going to send you a smiley, an emoji. You're going to get a text message with a yellow smiley face. That's what he says. Panim sochakot. You couldn't even describe it any better. Panim sochakot, panim tzubot. A yellow smiley face. And that yellow smiley face is God sending you the greatest signal. Like if you got a smiley face from God in the WhatsApp in the morning, what could be greater? What could be a greater feeling than if God sent you a smiley? When you see a smiley, think to yourself, don't think to yourself, oh, this is just a cheesy modern thing. This is a deep psychological, deep human connection, deeply a God message. The smiley face. Keep smiling. Like, think good thoughts.
I knew you were a breast lover at heart.
Well, at some place for sure. I'm definitely. Anyway, the point is that, what do you think? Smiley face? Do you see it? The first biblical smiley?
I hear it. I'm a little bit put off by the cheesy emoji reference, I have to admit. But because when I think of this, I go somewhere completely different. I don't know if you're familiar with the scholar Levinas.
Sure. I took postmodern thought in with Dr. Bevan at YU. Yeah.
You had a much better Jewish education than I did, my friend.
Yeah.
But one of the things that's always moved me about Levinas is that he, along with certain elements within the thought of the Maharal, identifies the Tzelem Elohim, the divine image within the face. Right? For all kinds of reasons, and it's very deep what he says, etc. And since it's Levinas, I won't even try to mangle it by explaining it. But one of the things that I've always taken away from what he says is that the face is the place where your inner life finds its most nuanced expression. It's the most malleable part of your physical being. Right? So therefore, if your inner life is going to find its expression in the world, it's going to happen in the face. And that's is how I see. These are the brachot, which, like you were pointing out, are very real, physical. They're not just abstract. God's going to give you a lot of cattle, and your cattle are going to be healthy, and your Bitcoin will do well, and all these things. That's like real world embodied blessings. But this one is saying, and by the way, you should just know that the whole world is smiling at you. Not that just the people. The world itself is a smile. Why? Because in the inside, God only wants kol kulo chesed. Only wants to give to you. And the place where you're able to read that invitation, where the world is malleable enough to express that inner desire is in the face. And so the great blessing is that you should feel the love and the smile through the whole world. And yeah. I'm not disagreeing with you.
You know what it is that the first thing, the deepest thing in the world is to think about God's face. What is God's face? It's like, just like you said, it's the most malleable and most expressive. It's also something that you probably like, you think God maybe has a hand. I mean, what's the word I'm looking for? An anthropomorphic hand. He's got an action set, but his face, that's like something that's like, I don't know. It's something that's like, that's Moses sees God face to face, speaks to them face to face. There's something very, very personal about God's face. And if he sends you that, you know, Ya'er Hashem Panav, like his face will shine onto you. That's like, that is the greatest joy and glory that a human being can attain. But I think that it's not a coincidence that the sun is yellow, the sun is life, the sun gives us joy. The idea of a smile is a very universal thing. And the smiley face is this thing that just came to represent very simply joy and good energy. And I think it's, you know, on the minimal level, it's like Rashi's saying this image, this icon is a universal icon of feeling joy. And feeling that relationship of joy, but to me, I like the thought that God could send you a type of thing that's easy for you to live with. All right, let's get actually. So speaking of that brings us right to the next and final section here that I want to cover with you today, and that's the very end of the Torah portion, and in the last two verses we're talking in the book of Numbers, chapter 7, verse 89, Bamidbar Zayin, Parshat Naso, Pasuk Pei Tet, Ubevo Moshe El Oel Moed, when Moses would come, or comes, into the tent of meeting, Ledaber Ito, to speak with him, Vishma Et HaKol, and he'll hear the voice, Midaber Elav, very interesting word, that on the simple level means that he's speaking to him. But Rashi explains midaber is that he hears God talking to himself.
Yeah, he's tuning into the God conversation.
Right.
But that God's the siach of creation, the conversation of creation is eternal. It's right. Not God talking to Moshe per se.
Right. I'll just read the Rashi midaber beino levein atzmo u'Moshe shomea me'elav. God is talking to himself. God has a conversation with God, has endless knowledge and information to give. Even when he's talking to us, if we think about it, he's really talking to himself. We're his created beings. But and Moses hears it. Mi'ala kaporet, from above the covering of the Aron, Asher ala Aron Ha'edut, which is on top of the Ark of the Covenant.
Testimony.
Ark of the Testimony. Testimony, mi ben shnei akruvim, from between the two cherubs, v'idaber elav, and he spoke to him. And to him, says Rashi, lema'et aron mina dibrot, that the dibrot, the talkings were really just to Moses. On the one hand, God is talking to himself, and we could all tune in. On the other hand, it was Moses who
Moses had the receiver.
Right, Moses was the receiver. He was the he had the receiver. Right, he had the ability to hear it.
I mean, part of that is a reflection of Anav Mikol Adam. The Moshe was the most humble of all men, mm-hmm. in the sense that he knew exactly who he was, so he could be completely open. He had the capacity to step into the tent of meeting and to actually enter and do this. By the way, in reference to your earlier Panim El Panim. This face-to-face relationship with God, that he was able to actually, whatever that really means, to encounter. But he was also able to empty himself out and receive. He wouldn't think God talking to me, right? Because the me element is the problem there. Like, oh, I hear God speaking. It's not that God is talking to me. Mm-hmm. There's a beautiful parallel to
this. This ties in very well with what we were talking about before with the narcissus problem with being narcissistic. It's like the opposite of that. He's not even talking to me. I have the great pleasure, the great honor of being able to hear him.
And in a beautiful sort of like, you know, you always have to weave these comments of Rashi, which are really echoing the Midrashim, you need to weave them together across the whole Torah in order to get his picture, because elsewhere, even though Yiri emphasizes that God was speaking to Moshe, not to Aaron, back in Shemot, after the commandment to sanctify the new moon, when the whole commanded relationship begins, really, with Am Yisrael, at least, as opposed to the individuals. There's a reference where the Moshe and Aaron, that God was speaking to them and they both spoke, because it says that Moshe would say to Aaron, you speak, and Aaron would say, no, you speak, and Moshe would say to you speak, and this is the dibul yatsami b'nehem, right? That the divine word actually came out from between them. Mm-hmm. So there's different aspects of the divine communication which is happening here. Here the focus is on Moshe. He's the right receiver because God is, you know, so as you like to say, broadcasting, you know, 24/7. There, it's the fact that you actually can't hear what God has to say without being in right relationship.
Mm-hmm. And our friend here on Periscope, Context Symphony, says, the nothingness from which the universe emerges is the same of Moses into which God pours his spirit.
Well, you froze in the middle of what you just said.
I said the nothingness from which the universe emerges is the same of Moses into which God pours his spirit. I think what he means to say that the world is a kind of empty slate, and so Moshe Rabbeinu is like a tohu vavohu, a willingness to hear God's message without putting himself into it. He is nothingness in that sense, ready to receive.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It needs to be a posture of being able to receive. And right. If this person's referring to the Chalal Panui, the sort of empty space, as the Rizal calls it, into which God shined the light of creation, it's very much, I can tell you from the counseling work I do, you can't hear a person until you make a space within yourself to allow their words to really echo. And that is absolutely what Moshe was able to do.
Well, I think this is a great place to stop. If we could bless each other and all of the folks joining us today, that at Shavuot, we'll create a space inside of ourselves to really receive that amazing light of Torah, which comes down on this 50th day of counting. And so it came down on the 6th of Sivan, 3,500 years ago. And so too, we have the chance to receive it yet again. God's Torah is new every single day, and there's something that he's telling us every day anew. Rabbi Mike Foyer, I want everybody to check out. First thing, we were talking about Parshat Naso. Here I have it up in Hebrew on the page. I want you to check that out. And I also want to wish everybody a happy – I want to wish everybody a happy Shavuot. I want everybody to join you, if possible, on jewishstory.co, jewishstory.co. That's Rav Mike Foyer, and you can find them on Facebook and on Twitter, either at Rav Mike Foyer or Jewish Story. So that's easy, and he's got great counseling work as well. If you need his profound advice, he's available. So that's the way to reach you. Or at how do we email you?
RavMikeFoyer@gmail.com.
Make it easy for us, RavMikeFoyer@gmail.com. I want to thank the good folks at Hebron Fund that allow the Jewish people to visit the fathers and the mothers in the beautiful city of Hebron, where I have the great, great privilege and honor and merit of working. And that is the home of the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matrix, the fathers and mothers of the Jewish people. And what else? Oh, of course, my website. Let's keep broadcasting together. Go over to yishaifleischer.com/donate. We're going to be hopefully continuing to broadcast the message of the centrality of the land of Israel, the return of God's presence to Zion, the ingathering of the Jewish people, and also a global light that's shining to the world, Be'ezrat Hashem. Finally, I want to say the Context Symphony says blessings, and Shaul says, when do you plan to be broadcasting next time? Shaul, we're always broadcasting. We'll be broadcasting again next week. What's that?
I said, but when will you tune in?
That's right. When will you tune in, Shaul? We, Be'ezrat Hashem, will be broadcasting again next week. Hopefully, we'll be making more broadcasts. Rabbi Mike Foyer, thank you again so much for joining me.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach and Shabbat Shalom. All right. And Rabbi Mike Foyer, thank you so much. And thank you, all of you, for being with me. Lots of love from the land of Israel. Blessings from the land of blessings. And more great stuff is on the way. So God bless you and shalom.
The Land of Israel Network is your connection to Israel and the Jewish world. Listen to our show hosts, Ari Abramowitz, Jeremy Gimpel, Eve Harrow, Josh Haston, Shlomo Katz, Mike Foyer, Yishai Fleischer, and more. Keeping you up to date on news, politics, and spirituality, that's the Land of Israel Network at thelandofisrael.com. Broadcasting the truth and beauty of Israel to the world.
All right, folks. Shalom and welcome back to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Judea to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. Lots of love to you from the land of Israel. Lots of love coming from this room in which Malka Fleischer joins
Yay.
Me. Shalom, Malka.
I don't have a lot of time for you today, Yishai. I got to get me into the kitchen. Make me some shavuos.
Yeah.
We don't eat a lot of dairy here on the on a regular basis. We're not like making all the dairy treats. So I feel particular pressure around Shavuot.
Oh, some people may not know this, but it is traditional to eat dairy foods on Shavuot. Various reasons have been given for that. My favorite is that Shavuot is actually the day in which Moses was fished out of the River Nile and that he rejected the Egyptian
milk
and was like, no thanks.
Lo toda.
I'm looking for some Hebrew mama to take care of me, okay? And that's the day of Chalav Yisrael. So we eat milk products. I myself become lactose intolerant on Shavuot as I am served too many.
Everyone is
milk
what?
Stuff.
Which Jew do you know who's like completely digesting lactose just fine?
Yeah, no,
you don't know any Jews like that.
No, I like having one meal.
That's basically that's what
it.
We do.
Yeah, that's what, yeah.
But here's what usually happens. What usually happens is we're like, we're going to make this one meal, and we're going to make this, and this. And then we just have so much leftovers that you have to eat more.
Do you know what it is, though? There is one thing. You always ask me what I want. You know that one thing that I do like?
I'm scared now because I'm about to go to the grocery store, and this is going to change everything.
Broccoli kugel? Yeah, I like the broccoli kugel.
Like a cheesy broccoli kugel?
Not too cheesy. Just a broccoli kugel. Yeah,
with big pieces or like blended?
No, big pieces.
Big pieces of broccoli kugel is what you want.
I'm not saying I want that. Huh. I'm saying I like that. Of the things that have to be eaten of the milk.
All right.
I can live with a broccoli kugel. That's it.
That's only a moderate adjustment.
Speaking of broccoli
to
kugel,
my plan.
Speaking of broccoli kugel, do you know what the Americans don't like in their kugel? They don't want too much Chinese food in their kugel, okay? What I mean to say is...
That was an amazing
transition. What I'm saying is...
That was
is
like
that
all the way.
The U.S. sent over the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, great friend of Israel. I love Mike Pompeo.
Seemingly.
Not seemingly. He is, in fact, a great friend of Israel.
I have a tendency to not trust anybody.
Okay, that's fine.
I guess that's just me.
That's fine. Also, you're post-corona, you know all that.
Right.
We don't trust anybody. Don't want to shake hands with other dirtbags. I mean, people. Anyway, I know what you mean. But all reports say that the discussion there was that Mike Pompeo was saying to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, I am concerned with too much Chinese investment in Israel.
Right.
You're a strategic ally.
Mm-hmm.
And instead... We want you to like not let them into your ports and into your 5G next gen.
5G, don't say 5G.
Whatever.
Everyone's trying to make me nervous about the 5G.
Whatever. I'm not going there right now. Don't let the Chinese too much into your technology.
Right.
And there was a specific story about a desalinization plant.
Desalination.
I knew that.
It makes sense, desalinization, but that's not
desalination.
That's not true.
Desalination.
It's desalination. Well, it turns out that on Tuesday, Israel's finance ministry named its winner for a bid to create what will be Israel's largest desalination plant and cheapest, by the way, like in the cost per metric liter or whatever they call it. There was a tight competition between Chinese company Hutchison Water, which, by the way, puts a little smile on my face.
Because that's not the real name.
It doesn't sound like a Chinese company, but right. maybe that's just me being, I don't know, something. But I like the name, basically. I like the name Hutchison Water.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But Hutchison Water, a Chinese company, wanted the contract as part of the Hong Kong-based CK Hutchison Group. But less than 2 weeks after U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo made like a quick visit to Israel, as Bibi had just like put together the government and everyone's talking about the Trump administration deal of the century plan for Israel and the Palestinian movement. He came in and then bam, all of a sudden, a company called IDE Technologies, an Israeli company, won the tender, and it is going to build the Sorek 2 plant south of Tel Aviv, which by 2023 is expected to produce 200 million cubic meters a year of desalinated water, which is going to be like a third of Israel's desalinated water. It's a beast, this plant.
Yeah, it's a beast. Let me just break that down. Like, the way you said it is good. I just want to say it a little bit differently, which is that Mike Pompeo flew in specifically. Mm-hmm. There's many other issues around the globe, especially the coronavirus.
Right.
Flew in just to talk to Israel for a few hours, turned around. It was a shuttle lightning bolt diplomacy moment. And the major issue was the China issue, seemingly, and
so
the Iran issue.
Yeah, they say it was Iran. They say it was China. But who knows what goes on.
But it was eyeball to eyeball. Okay?
It was eyeball to eyeball.
Not Zoom.
I agree with you. You know, we started the show a little with me being a little bit like holding back on the Secretary Mike Pompeo. But the truth is that Secretary Pompeo has seemed to be pretty consistently pro-Israel. But Israel's in this like interesting moment right now with the United States. We've been through a lot with the U.S. in the last few years since the administration moved from hands of Obama to hands of Trump. And for a while, it felt like we were just going to like break glass ceilings all over the place when it came to Israeli sovereignty in Judea and Samaria, and us just like plowing ahead with all kinds of Zionist plans that we had had for so long. But now it's a little bit more complicated feeling. We have the Trump administration basically pulling back on us and saying they don't want us to perform any kind of sovereignty moves in Judea and Samaria. For a while, first they said Israel can do it whenever they want. Now they say that Israel should hold off and they shouldn't do anything without U.S. approval, which seems to be like a rolling back of the kind of enthusiastic support for Israel that the administration seemed to have. Now you have the United States also getting very involved. I mean, maybe this happened before in Israeli history and we just didn't see it in the news. But now it seems to be that the news is reporting that the U.S. is getting very involved in Israel's business, literally, that the United States basically thwarted the deal between Hutchison and the government to create the water desalination
plant.
But
if you say
it
like that, you know, there were other bidders. And they claim that it's much cheaper than the Chinese bid. But that's all besides the point. I don't know if the word thwarted is right. It was more like, look, this is a strategic danger for the United States. It might also be a strategic danger for you.
So seemingly the United States,
if you ask me, I'm much happier that a Tel Aviv-based organization.
Right, so that's the flip side, right? It's like, it's not like the United States came in and was like, listen,
take
you got to use our
company. Right.
They were like, use an Israeli company. Now, as a person who sends my husband off to America from time to time when it's not like a locus of viral plague, I know about the value of sometimes getting things from the outside. Sometimes things are cheaper from the outside. Yeah. Things are better quality from the outside. Yeah. And sometimes when you have to get things from the inside, then it feels less good. But there's, of course, a great value to using an Israeli company, and surely it's going to help the economy and it's going to help create jobs in Israel. And I know that the United States is on a big push to bolster American industry, American business, and do things with America. Some people say that's part of the reason that there's tension between the United States and China, not to mention, of course, we have this coronavirus mystery which still hangs in the air. And that's part of what Pompeo kind of came to Israel seemingly to say, which was don't have China be a major part of any infrastructure work that you do because they're not fully trustworthy. That's basically what they're saying. And on the one hand, it feels like we're being used, right, as part of a U.S.-China battle. And that we're in the middle of the battle. And the United States is, you know, pulling our string a little bit to get us to do what they want, because we're their ally and they're our ally. And it makes sense for us to kind of lean toward their preference. On the other hand, I kind of tend to agree just on a natural level. It's sometimes it feels to me like, well, the Chinese people, you see them online. They come here to Israel and they talk about Israel, and you meet them in person. Of course, they're amazing, wonderful, good, wonderful, best-hearted people who do good things, honest people. But when you get to the upper echelons of China, it seems a little bit ruthless, the whole government there. And I'm sort of I wouldn't put it past a major Chinese power player to do something that in Israel that we wouldn't want.
Yeah.
In
general, we've learned also that, like, we have to depend on ourselves. The only thing I want to say about what you just said is that if America doesn't want us to give away our ports or our desalination plants to the China, I say I welcome that. Now, let's not talk about giving away our land to the hating terrorists.
To our version of China, basically.
Much
worse in the sense.
Yeah, because they're overt enemies. They're overt enemies. Why would we give away our land, which is wrong in itself? I wouldn't give our land away to Bugs Bunny or to Mickey Mouse. I mean, to say it doesn't have to be the nicest people in the world. I wouldn't want to give away our land. And certainly not to our enemies either. And it's just like, I get it. You don't want us to give away our ports to China, which is your enemy. Why would you want us to give away our land to our enemy?
Right.
And by the way, to America's enemy as well. So I think I'm going to push for that line. And I hope we're going to see more independence, more pride in the Israeli heartland, which really gives us so much of the flavor of what Israel is really about.
Now, just to back up something that you said, Yishai, Energy Minister Yuval Steinitz is saying, he basically played down the idea that Washington influenced this deal.
Mm-hmm.
He told Khan Public Broadcaster that earlier this month at the meeting between Pompeo and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, it didn't seem to me that this plant was at the forefront of American interests. And he said, this is a quote, "The proposal by the Israeli company was significantly better than all the competitors, including the Chinese."
Okay, but that's...
So it could also be, as we analyze this story and go through it, it could just be that there's an interest in certain sectors, including in the media, to play up this story as a U.S. manipulation story, as a Trump administration, to kind of sully the Trump administration in the eyes of the pro-Israel community and say, hey, here they come, and they're like getting all intertwined and enmeshed in our stuff, and we don't want that.
I'm just happy to see an Israeli company.
So who even knows
bid.
Anymore?
By the way, there's an effort to influence Israel unduly by having a missionary channel, right?
That's right, also, God TV.
A lot of people always want to get into Israel. That's a biblical and ancient idea.
Well, that's a classic historical...
Right. Rashi says that Joshua had to defeat 31 kings in the land of Israel. He's like, why were there 31 kings in the land of Israel?
And
he's
didn't even fully succeed in doing that.
He's like, why? Because everybody wants a part in Israel. They always sent their emissaries and they wanted to build their embassies. They wanted to build their churches. They wanted to build their mosques. They wanted to build their idolatry. They always wanted to have a piece of the land of Israel. And really, since Zionism woke up, my take on Zionism is that modern Zionism, its major schwung is going to start happening really in the 1700s. And we're living in, but the real initial moment of modern Zionism starts in 1492. That's my take.
When Columbus sailed the ocean blue.
Yes. And also when Ferdinand and
Isabella.
Right. They kick out the Jews out of Spain. The big diaspora thing is broken. A new diaspora thing is reborn in America, but also the Arizal appears in Sfad and kind of wakes up this consciousness of returning to the land of Israel. That's my belief. I believe 1492. I believe that other people along the way kept it going, but the real ping of rebirth happened around the early 1500s as a result of 1492. But the modern push is in the middle 1700s. But since then, everybody's trying to stick in their business into our business. And so I'm you know, if it was an American, if it was like Halliburton or something like that won this.
Right. Then you'd be like, I'd be like,
that's
okay. Fishy.
But if an Israeli company won this tender, that's really good. Malka, we're coming into Shavuot.
Right.
Today, we're counting 48 days here.
Ooh, 48.
I want to first thing congratulate you.
Yes. I want to congratulate you for clinging on to me as I tried to fly off the track of the Omer so many times and pulling me back on all the time.
I have so many Omer alarms. I have Omer emails, Omer WhatsApps.
You listen to Omer Adam during this time.
I listen to Omer. I got Omer emails, Omer WhatsApps, Omer alarm that I set on my phone, on my calendar. Every day it says Omer. And I've got an Omer wristband, which I like wear a special wristband in order to remind me it's the Omer. So we're at 48. I don't want to say what tonight's number is.
Oh, we're not going to say.
But really.
But we're doing it. We're doing it. We're so close. And
that's why I was thinking about calling the show like something 49ers. You know,
that's funny.
Yeah, but the 49ers. You know, we're the flying 49ers. I don't know.
It's interesting because we spend a lot of energy, mental energy, trying to like count the Omer and make sure that we're counting the Omer.
Yeah.
But I think there are a lot of books that help with this. Maybe we need to get a book. But I tend to feel that it doesn't feel like we're counting up to this receiving of the Torah on the personal level. Meaning to say, like, I sort of wish that I felt after the Omer that I had like reached a spiritual apex where I'm now like,
you got worried. A day and a half, sister.
Now I guess I better work on that.
You got a day and a half to get psyched about it.
I am psyched. I'm not psyched. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not talking about excitement or enthusiasm. I'm talking about like spiritual readiness.
Yeah.
To receive like the God and to get his info and to get his mission and to be like holy. Do you know what I mean?
I have a feeling that the coronavirus was a special thing in this time.
Right.
And that it did do something on a national level. A lot of things happened during this corona period. A lot.
Right.
One, the formation of the government. After like a lot of fails, it happened. And a realignment of American Jewry versus Israeli Jewry. I think that American Jewry really felt for the first time that they were less safe in America, and things just changed and are going to change. There's going to be like a realization. Just we have members of the family who left New York City and like left their house.
They left. They like got movers to come and move their stuff for them, and they put it on the market.
Right. They're out. They're out. Right.
I read an article. I don't know if it was in the New York Times. That basically this is not unusual, that a lot of people are moving out of New York, families in particular.
Right.
And that they expect that an influx of like young single
right.
type people will start to move into New York.
I saw a map of where the disease hit in the United States. And really, the major strike of this disease was in the
Northeast, tri-state area.
Yeah, really in the not even Northeast, really New York. In Long Island.
New York, New Jersey, Long Island, Massachusetts.
Right. And really like struck it where the Jewish centers are. And I think that there's going to be a reassessment about American Jewry's stability for the survivors and certainly the sense that it's not the stable kind of,
you can't stay on that track.
Right. That it's not, it doesn't have a future orientation so much. And I think that people are going to either know that intellectually, but more likely just going to feel that somewhere in the subconscious that's just not the same. And Israel's just got a different light right now. It's just got a different light. And I've reached a stark conclusion that just like it tells us that Rome and Jerusalem can't coexist at the same time, that maybe what the real meaning of that verse is, the verse that says Leom Milom Yamatz, is that really diaspora Jewry and Israeli Jewry cannot be both at peak strength at the same time. One has to rule, and the other one has to be either gone or subservient.
Subservient is not such a nice word. One is stronger and one is weaker.
Right, but I don't mean subservient in a subservient sense. I mean, like, it's not the leading.
It's either Jerusalem or Babylon.
Right, it's either Jerusalem or Babylon, exactly. And Babylon, when I was a boy,
right, it was
when I was a boy,
the power center.
Right, Jerusalem was subservient, if you will, to Babylon, and I've seen it, Malka, with my own eyes. It's shifted, and you know, sometimes when scales tip, when they start to tip, suddenly they tip hard. Mm-hmm. That's just the nature of scales.
I wonder how hard this tip was. I talked to somebody yesterday who told me that he talked to a lot of his friends in America, like I would say a man in his 60s. And he told me that he was talking to his friends in New York, New Jersey. And he said that this coronavirus, and I'm interested if we have listeners there, if they'll confirm or deny, but that he heard that it really shook people up.
Yes, that's what I'm
saying. In terms of... Like, obviously, what they went through is just shaking up by itself.
Right.
But that, like you said, or are saying, that it shook them up in terms of where do they feel safe? Where do they feel that they should be at home?
Right.
You're talking, of course, about major tectonic shifts of spiritual power. But even on the micro level, I think we're talking about Jews asking themselves, did I feel good about... where I just did this personal emergency.
Did I shelter in place?
Was it my place? Like, if something like this were to happen again, right. God forbid,
right?
Is this where I would want? Like, yeah. Is this how I would want it to look?
Yeah, I'd like to write an article on that. I'm going to call it "Shelter in Place."
Nice.
I like that.
You're writing it down as we speak.
Yeah, because you know when a good idea comes in.
Right. So.
Speaking of good ideas, we want to start here at the Yishai Fleischer World slash Kuma, that organization that you and I founded so many years ago that's still so active. We want to start moving ahead, doing more stuff, and we want to start some swag. We are swag creators. So if you let me know what is interesting to you.
Yeah, what do you want?
What kind of stuff do you want? Like hats, sweatshirts, cups, things. Like, we got
more alternative stuff.
Or alternative stuff, you know what I mean? Let us know, and we're going to start working on that. What other stuff do you want from us? Like let's say if somebody would give a monthly donation, would you want like tours in the land of Israel? Like, what's interesting to you? What is the stuff that you guys want? What is your call? Like, what's a? I'm actually, before I give you the call to action, what's the call to action that you'd like to hear? Like, what is the step that you want to be more connected to the concept of building Israel together?
We're always happy to get your feedback here at the Yishai Fleischer Show on this and on any other matter.
That's right.
And I just want to remind people that they can find you on Twitter.
Yes.
They can find you on Facebook. Yes. Me too. They can find us on Instagram.
Right.
That you also email.
That's
Yishai,
right.
Where do you like people to email you?
Either if you're feeling connected to the Land of Israel Network, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Or if you're coming out from the Yishai Fleischer world, so it's yishai@yishaifleischer.com. It's really pretty easy. I want to give people, you know, inroads in. And
we'd love to get your emails. I got somebody sent me a series of recipes for Shavuot, just like I asked for in last week's show.
You mean
Eric?
Our good friend Eric, of course. Ugh, Eric is the man.
His mom wrote a cookbook.
Yes.
It's called Nan with in a Pan.
With a Pan. Nan with a Pan. No? Nan in a Pan? Okay, maybe I'm wrong. But I do see you reading it.
I got to go look now.
Okay, hold on one second. Let me pause the recording.
I was totally wrong. It's Nan and a Pan.
Nan and a Pan.
Wonderful. You said Nan with a Pan, and I said Nan in a Pan, which that it can't possibly be right.
That's weird.
But Nan in a Pan, like some great dairy recipes. And she has basically just been cooking awesomeness for her family for so long.
Isn't Wisconsin famous for dairy?
She wrote down her own cookbook.
Isn't Wisconsin famous for dairy stuff like cheese?
Right.
Yeah.
So those recipes should be better than others.
That's right. And if you want to send Malka a recipe, please do so ASAP.
Yes, okay? Hurry up.
Hurry up. That's right.
It's an emergency.
That's right. And then I'm very excited for Shavuot. I'll tell you the truth. Shavuot, Feast of Weeks, Pentecost, okay, is actually my in one way, my favorite holiday.
What do you love about it? What's your favorite part?
It's mysterious.
True.
It's mysterious. It's not. It's mysterious. But the mystery of Shavuot is, to me, it's standing at the foot of Mount Sinai in Jerusalem receiving the Torah. And I can feel it, and I feel, because it is a national, it's a day of national achievement. It's a time of national achievement. I could feel it, and I cry. I cry every year. Really, I can't help it.
You cry cheese curds.
Yeah, I cry. Little
cottage cheeses.
Yeah. If we were like in the Lego movie, it would be those little blue, like little
circles.
Button circles. Yeah. You know what I mean? I just feel tremendously emotional about Shavuot, and I'm excited about it. It's the most Eretz Yisrael of the holidays. Passover is about...
What?
Of course.
I guess that's kind of true.
Passover...
I was going to say Sukkot because you're outside on Eretz Yisrael Mamash.
Yes.
But not if you don't live in Israel, then you're not. But then they say... Of course, there are people who say that the Sukkah is like being in Eretz Yisrael.
Yes, yes. All the holidays are Eretz Yisrael holidays. I'm not saying they're not. But Pesach is about the exodus from Egypt. Sukkot is about in the desert. Now you could say also receiving the Torah at Mount Sinai. Yes, but there's something about... First thing, the Temple Mount jumped to Mount Sinai. And that's where we really received it from, because from Jerusalem will come forth Zion. It will come forth, from Jerusalem shall come forth Torah. Thank you. Ki mitzion tetzeh Torah udvar Hashem miYerushalayim. But furthermore, it's compared to Isaac, the forefather Isaac, who never left the land of Israel.
Hmm.
And there's something about it. It's about the fields. It's about the wheat. It's about King David. It's about the Baal Shem Tov. It's like a holiday that, like, all the stuff that, like, is very, very close to my heart, like, just is smushed into one. It's about the Baal Shem Tov's birthday and passing day. It's King David's birthday and passing day.
That's cool.
It's Shavuot.
You like that, like, you got that, like, mystical undertone going on.
It is a mystical holiday. It is not, and that's how you know people who aren't really close to Judaism, who practice some other form to Judaism or you know, they don't know Shavuot. It's for the people who receive the Torah.
It's not
for people who kind of do it. It's for the inner. The counting is for the inner. It's for the what they call pnimiyut Torah. You know what I mean? It's
the Torah.
Torah, the inner Torah, not the outer Torah. And so it's a marvelous holiday, and it's also a bang. It's like one day. Truth is that the halacha is that you can, for another week, you can come bring sacrifices in Yerushalayim. But that one night, it's like...
Right. That's the super juice.
It's the big one. Now, personally, I love to go up on the Temple Mount, and this year Temple Mount's going to be closed. I don't know what I'm going to do.
We registered. I don't know if we mentioned it last week, but we registered for tickets... For the Kotel, I think we did talk about it.
Yeah.
And you were only allowed to register either for night of Shavuot, meaning to say from midnight until 7 a.m. And people like to daven what's called nets, which is like as the sun is rising.
Right. I call it Vatican Minion.
Vatican, right.
It's a little joke of mine.
Right,
yeah. Yes. It's a little joke for Eric. I call it Vatican Minion. Which means really Vatican.
Right.
Which is, you know, get at the crack of dawn. The crack of dawn.
Right.
Yeah.
So you had to reserve tickets for that or for Shabbat day.
Right.
Davening, where you hear the Torah reading and everything. And you could only try to get a ticket for one. And they were only picking like 500 people for each group.
Right.
Of each of the two different davenings. And I was really hoping that you would get a ticket. And you didn't.
No, I did not.
You did not get a ticket.
That's
you did not
so
win.
Bad.
But then I talked to our friends in the Old City, Yishai, and they said that those particular times from 12 at midnight until 7 a.m. and then again in the morning on Shabbat are the only times you need tickets. If you want to come to the Kotel, any other time during the 2 days of Chag and Shabbat, then you can. But it's like a first come, first serve, and you may have to wait in a line, and you may not get in, and this and that. But you are allowed to go to the Kotel.
Do you want to go to the Kotel?
Maybe. I was thinking about it. We gotta talk about it, because it's definitely a schlep and a half from your mom's place in Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim, Baruch Hashem, is a big city, so it's like an hour and a half, some kind of insane
maybe,
in the membrane walk.
I have
but
an
on
idea.
The other hand, it's
maybe
beautiful
go,
to go
maybe
to
we
the
go
hotel.
Towards like Sudash Lishit on Shabbat.
On Shabbat, maybe.
And then we'll grab a cab back home.
Wise.
Nice.
There's some wisdom in what you're saying.
Let's do it. Let's do it. Okay, that sounds
There's
awesome.
There's some wisdom in what you're saying, because to go to Yerushalayim and stay there and not go to the hotel for holidays and Shabbos.
That's matok though. That
yeah,
thought is matok.
I don't want to miss it.
And this, it's,
yeah. All right. We'll see. We'll see if we can get a little Sudash Lishit hookup.
That's right. All right, folks. You are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show. Malka Fleisher joins me. Malka, thank you so much
yes,
for joining me.
Thank you very much.
In both in life
oh.
and in this room right now on the show. I do want to encourage everybody to please connect. There's so many ways to connect. There's so many ways to do, to be full of, action and connectivity, feel the inner call to action. One of the ways to do that is to check out our sponsors, including Tchelet, T-E-K-H-E-L-E-T. Okay, if you want the true blue Jew strings, wear them and really want to accept upon yourself a new mitzvah, I highly, highly, highly recommend it. I love it. I'm wearing one right now, and I have a brand new tzitzit in that drawer right
wow,
over there.
Wow, exciting. Are you taking
for
it out
Shavuos.
For Shavuot? That's
yes,
nice.
Yes, I shall.
As I told you guys last week, I have used up my tzitzit gift for the boys. So we'll just have to give them shirts.
Right. Okay. And then also I want to recommend people check out HebronFund.org. You can have a lot of fun by checking out Hebron Fund and visiting us soon when Corona time will be over. Come back to the land of Israel ASAP and come to first come to Jerusalem, then come to the mamas and the papas in Hebron. That's just the way to do it. Okay. You got to come to Yerushalayim.
Sister cities.
That's right. That's right. That's our sister city. That's exactly right. That's exactly what Ben-Gurion Alav HaShalom said. And of course, visit us if this show is important to you, if this Torah is important to you, then visit us at YishaiFleisher.com and support our show. Hit the donate button and be part of the effort to spread Torah and Israel-centered consciousness to the world. And also, of course, our wonderful network, which is the Land of Israel Network. Check out thelandofisrael.com, where we have fabulous shows, including a lot of effort that our good friend Jeremy Kimpel, Rabbi Jeremy Kimpel, is trying right now, along with Tehillah and other stuff that he's doing. People are moving. They're
right.
moving, and we just had a great men's evening at the farm.
That's so nice.
It was great. It was just a great hangout.
Although you
time.
Guys did not eat my chicken wings that I marinated for you guys for a whole day.
That's true, because we had overcooked other meats, but we ate that the next night.
That's right.
So Baruch Hashem, and happy Shavuot, everybody. Stay tuned. Stay strong. Stay connected. Be plugged in. If you didn't do it, use every last ounce and moment that you can right now of strength and any time that you have to get ready for Shavuot and to really embrace it. And if you need to hear the Book of Ruth, the whole thing, I sent it out last week, but please check out my podcast. I think it's Miraculous Midnight Rendezvous.
Maybe you'll put it back up. Maybe you'll put a link to it, re-upload it to Facebook, to Twitter, so that people will be able to
actually,
find
you're
it.
Right. It's on my Facebook page right now. It's on my Facebook page. All right, folks. More great stuff. Malka Fleisher. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you so
Chag
much. Chag Sameach. I'm
Hashem
so happy that your favorite holiday is coming.
Amen.
I hope it's just as moving as you hope.
And may this holiday also bring blessings and healing to the world. Amen. Shalom, everybody. God bless you.